Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Dr. Dave Mather, a retired commander with 38 years of law enforcement experience, 22 of those active, owner and operator of What's a Mather Consulting, where he goes around the world teaching organizations on deliberate leadership, culture change, and public safety consulting. Dave has worked with more than 400 agencies around the world supporting public safety and the communities they serve. Yes, you heard and read that right, with law enforcement. Dave came highly recommended from Ricky Esco Escalero, who told me I had to get him on and talk anything and everything leadership. Dave did not disappoint and hit so many targets when it came to leadership and organizations that I'm sure any firefighter listening will be able to relate to. Realizing it's acceptable to incorporate outside instruction in a learning environment, such as a guest speaker, can be a positive step for enhancing employee engagement and providing diverse learning experiences. This shift can foster a more holistic and enjoyable learning environment for the organization. With that, I present Dr. Dave Mather.
So my name is Dave Mather, and gosh, yes, how I got into law enforcement or why I got into it. To be honest, I actually thought I was going to be an airline pilot. I was headed towards the Air Force Academy. Even going through high school, everybody knew me as the guy that was going to go to the military and fly jets. And then I was going to go, I mean, I grew up in the Top Gun era, right? So, You know, everybody wanted to go fly jets. That's everybody in high school. In fact, several of my buddies from high school did just exactly that. I actually flew down to a college, Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona. And while I was there, when I came back to a restricted night license because I was colorblind. Well, I'd always known I was colorblind. I never had looked far enough to find out that that was something that would exclude me because I hadn't done the medical yet. So it kind of sent my world in a spin, and I was looking for something to go to school, trying to figure out what to do. The local police department had an opportunity where you could dispatch for their police department for 32 hours a week. You had 4 8-hour shifts, usually on the graveyard shift. In exchange, they paid full room and board, full tuition, $110 a quarter for books, and $80 a month, what they called a stipend and we called pizza and beer money. And basically, I was going back to college with this no clue. Like, literally everything in high school was, this is what I'm going to do. And so, now everything's changed. Mm-hmm. And so while I was there, one of the things that struck me is, I remember thinking, who do you call when things are going crazy and we don't know what to do? And the idea, it struck me that, the people that do this kind of work, fire service, police, public safety in general, military, same, is that, like, we are that last line of defense in whatever version that comes about. And there was something about that that appealed to me, and also, to be perfectly fair, felt almost too big, like scary big. Like, it was never something I'd considered. And so I kind of decided that until I grew up and figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up, I was just going to, kind of hang around law enforcement. Here I am now, 40 years later. I guess I haven't grown up. So, what I loved about it was that, there was a part of my personality that wanted the unknown and the dynamic environment, to have to think on my toes, certainly to provide a service that took care of the community itself. I also, on some level, liked the idea of helping those who couldn't help themselves in whatever version that looked like. And that didn't always mean making arrests. Sometimes it meant, helping people with a neighborhood problem, or, figuring out how to get them, get their license cleared up so they could go back to work and take care of their family. I mean, all of that just kind of appealed to me. And again, I never felt an urge to leave. So I kind of came into it in a really weird way. and then just kind of found my home once I was there.
Okay. All right. And so when you finally got that notion within yourself, like this is what I wanted to do, what steps did you take? Like, is I'm assuming the police department is kind of like the fire department. You have to apply and you apply in many different jurisdictions.
Yes. And of course it's changed too, right? Like when I, I routinely tell people now that when I was applying, there were probably 10, 15 people for every job opening in public safety at that time. Like you were competing with people around you. If you had military background, you had preference points. If you had done the job somewhere else or volunteered somewhere else, you got it. And so I was a both a, I had been in the Army and done a 2-year stint in Hawaii of all places. And so I had military experience, and then I also had I had worked as a reserve officer. I'd worked as a dispatcher or a communications officer for our small city, which was both police and fire in our city. And so, I mean, I got hired by the same agency that had given me a chance to dispatch and go to college. And yeah, I remember feeling how lucky I was because I knew that there had been a bunch of other people who really wanted that job as well, who, when I looked at them, I thought they were good candidates. I had several chances to leave. I worked for a city called Cheney, Washington. I was the 12th officer hired. It's a very small agency. But the city always was good to me. Every time I got to the point where I would start to feel like I might get bored or I'd want that next adventure or what else could I do? Excuse me. The right opportunities popped up. They'd give me a chance to be a field trainer or to be an investigator or to teach DARE for a while, which I didn't want to do. It ended up being one of the better things that I did in my career because of, learning to interact in a way in uniform that I had not done up until that point. So yeah, I didn't leave until I ended up, leaving to go and run a program for the Department of Justice after about 22 years. So
Wow.
yeah.
Okay. And but before you left, what was your current rank?
I left as a commander. We had, in our agency, we had patrol side and administration side, and the two of us that were kind of in those roles would kind of alternate back and forth. And so we all worked directly for the chief, and we just took half of the department basically. You either took the uniform side or you took all of the support side of things, including our communication center, and chaplains and training and vehicles and all of the, again, it very oversimplified to small agency because you get basically the people who are out there actively in uniform doing the work, and you get everything that's supporting that. And we would just kind of rotate back and forth. So yeah, I'd come up through the ranks, and I'll say this, I had been a fairly well respected field training officer, but I struggled as a sergeant. And I didn't understand why. I struggled in that role because as I when I promoted into sergeant, I was excited. I'd been the union president. I figured I'm coming into this. I'm well respected. People know me. I've trained most of the guys here. It just felt like, wow, things are just rolling along. And then I got to that role, and one of the things that I didn't understand is I thought if I do all the right behaviors, like if I do all the right things, what's a list of what a good leader does? And if I do that, then I'm going to be a good sergeant. Well, there were two problems with that. The first was that I was trying to emulate other people instead of being me. I had seen what other people had done. And instead of just taking that on and making it my own and approaching my leadership style with that's a part of my leadership style, I tried to act like I saw them act, which is insincere, and people know it. I mean, there's a lack of authenticity about that, and because of that, it really kind of was just always a little bit standoffish. Like they knew that wasn't me, and I know that sounds like a weird thing on one level, but again, I was just trying to, what's a script of the greatest things you could do to be a good leader? And the other part of it was, I would have, there's no question, I would have passed a polygraph if asked to take one about whether I cared about my people. I loved the people I worked with. I would show up if I heard they were moving. I'd just show up with my truck and help out. I would help them. I helped re-roof houses. I helped, put in air conditioners. I did all the things that we do in the public safety world about taking care of our brothers and sisters who are in need. But when it came to the work stuff, I treated you, if you work for me, like you were a tool to get my job done. And I didn't understand how that little piece of how I addressed and interacted with you in the work spot had such a profound difference in how people respond. And that I didn't learn that until years later. So
Okay.
struggled through that piece of it.
And so with that,
Yeah.
can you describe your leadership experiences throughout your career? Things you
Yeah.
saw, the things you were like, stay away from, but it's, with the fire service, they always say you learn from good and bad leadership.
Perfect.
So what were your experiences?
Yeah, so I had some pretty good leaders. I mean, like anybody, I mean, I didn't realize how good I had it at first. And what I mean by that is our city was a fairly ethical city. The people who did the job in the law enforcement and the fire and throughout even the politicians were all there genuinely trying to do what's right for it. And I think most places are like that, but every once in a while you run into places where there's ulterior motives that go on instead. So I was lucky in that sense. I also had leaders who were doing the best that they could do. And again, I was naive. When I first started, I was a preacher's kid. And there's a kind of the running joke in the law enforcement world that if you're a preacher's kid, you're either the one that we chase around at nighttime because you're, acting out, or you're so sheltered you don't know how the world works. And I guess fortunately, I was more of the second one than the first one. So I worked with people who genuinely were trying to do the right things, to the best of their ability. But I also saw that, so you have those leaders who play favorites. You're my guy, so I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to give you the opportunity, and it was great if you're the one that's being favored. You never feel like when you're in that in group, like you're the one being favored. You just feel like you deserve it, right? But when you're the in the out group, and you know that this has less to do with how I'm performing and more to do with the relationship that you've got with somebody, that hits you. I mean, that kind of steals a lot of it pisses people off. I mean, often it creates that frustration that we lash out. And instead of dealing with it in positive ways, we tend to get really negative. That's why I actually ran for union president, because I was mad. And nothing worse than a pissed off union president who wants to fight because he feels like he owes it back to the organization. So I did not have a, I mean, that path, interestingly enough, was, as a young officer trying to do my best, but certainly fairly naive. I also had some people who, I had a couple, I remember one older officer that we went to a call one night. One of the officers who was fighting with somebody, and he's one of those guys who never called and asked for help. So the fact that he was not just asking, but you could hear in his voice he needed help. And so it hits you different when it's somebody who never asks and you can just hear it in their voice. I'm moving, and we got there and everything was fine there. But the senior officer asked a roadside with me a little bit later, and he said, "Hey, we're in a college town." He said, "You were driving close to 100 miles an hour on a Friday night." And he said, "Well, I understand what you were trying to do to get there and help your partner. How likely is it that somebody stumbles out from between cars, not paying attention to what they're doing at nighttime? And what's the result?" I mean, he took the time to just pull me aside and challenge. And I remember, like, if I'm being fair, I was pissed off that night. But it made me think. And what I really appreciated as I grew older was he didn't, he pulled me aside. It was a senior officer giving me the benefit of his experience. And that later became such an important part of what I do and how I do it, is that influence over authority. That idea, I can, if I've got, if I've got the right rank hanging on my collar, I can order you to do anything. But I'm going to get what I refer to as BAM. That's an acronym for the bare ass minimum. You're going to do enough that I will leave you alone. But as soon as I'm not looking, if you don't want to do it, you're not going to do it. When you talk about leading through the lens of authority, what am I wearing on my collar? I can make people do things, but it's very ineffective. And the reality is, when we talk about wanting to motivate people to do the right things, what we want them to do is, I want you to be motivated to do it because you know it's the right thing to do. And in order for me to get to that point where you feel like it's the right thing to do, I've got to work through the lens of influence over authority. And so seeing people like Carl, who took me aside and challenged what I did, and again, he had no, I mean, he was around longer than I was. So just like anything, a senior guy is going to have a little more clout than the new guy does. But in terms of rank, we're the same rank. So he didn't have formal authority, but he had influence. And what I realized later is that the way in which that affected me, I went back and took those lessons and incorporated them into how I did them, because I knew he was right, even if I didn't like, my pride was hurt in the moment. And that became such an important part, as I later learned, when I was not getting good response from people as a first line supervisor and couldn't figure out why, I started thinking about who were the people who were most effective that I had watched as leaders, and Carl came back to mind. And it was that idea of influence over authority. And influence at its heart is the quality nature of the relationship. If I work for you and I trust you, you can cuss me out for doing the wrong thing, and I will feel like I let you down because I care about you and I know you care about me. You've earned that influence over me, that you holding me accountable feels like I failed you. I feel bad because on some level, man, I know I should have done this better. I'm really disappointed that somebody I have respect for was disappointed by the outcome. That's influence. But that's built off of genuine relationship. You can't script out, okay, a good leader says these words and does those things. I'll say it a different way, Danny. If you've ever had somebody chew you out, and you knew that they loved you, that you knew they cared about you, you knew that they were holding you accountable because they knew you were better than what you did. And that feeling you feel after they have that piece just kind of really resonated with you. Think about the exact same words, and take those exact same words said in the exact same way, and move it on to somebody you don't have respect for, and how much different that hits. It's not about those behaviors. It's not about saying the right things. It's about the underlying core of the relationship that you and I have together that determines whether my behaviors of holding you accountable or you holding me accountable are received the way they should be. Similarly, let's take it the other side. Even if I say to you, hey, you did absolutely fantastic on this. I saw I saw how you were working with the other folks here. I loved how you were interacting. We had that guy out there who he was trying to get anybody to fight him, and you took him and just settled him right down, got him taken care of, made sure that he was okay. And I really liked what you did. Now, if think about that same set of behaviors, if you respect me as the leader, that's going to hit like a real compliment, and it's going to feel good. If you don't respect me as a leader, if we don't have trust, you're going to wonder, what am I up to? Why am I giving you a compliment? What's in it for me? And I think that probably more than anything else in the course of my journey as a leader was the biggest epiphany, because I kept thinking, if you do all the right behaviors, you're going to be a good leader. But the behaviors are secondary. You still have to do the right behaviors, but the core of it is what we call underlying mindset. What is it? How do I see you? Do I see you as a human being that I value, that I care about, who I recognize is going to have some strengths and weaknesses, things you do really well and some things you struggle at, and the thing and that I care about you, and that my holding you accountable or giving you kudos or everything else is genuinely a part of a caring about you. And that doesn't mean, placating to you. I can literally fire somebody while caring deeply about them, or I can fire them and not give a damn about them, and they're going to hit different.
Right.
So yeah,
Okay. No,
that
I
probably
love
is the
it.
biggest one, Danny. That one in particular was such an epiphany to me, because again, I wanted to be a good leader. So write down all the right behaviors, and that's
Yeah.
not enough. So.
Okay. When it comes to accountability, I know from my experiences and my talks that I've had with other people, it's something that a lot of individuals feel like their department can improve on or that's lacking. But it's also my experience when someone says, I want, the department to hold people accountable, they say that up until the department decides to hold that particular person accountable.
Isn't
So,
that true?
what's your take on accountability?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of like change. I want things to change, but I don't want to change. It's like I recognize that this isn't the way it should be. I think we all recognize when we see things that should be addressed. And I think this is one of those places I use the term likership over leadership. If my goal in if you're working for me and my goal is to make you like me, then I'm going to do things that are about trying to win your trust through what can I do for you. And I think a lot of young leaders in particular make the mistake of believing that that's more effective, that's going to make them more effective as a leader. And I guess if you've ever played sports, if you've had a good coach, they don't let you get away with not doing your job on the team. In fact, they may yell at you and bench your ass and make you run lines until they throw up, because what you're doing is letting yourself down and your teammates down and this organization, the team, down. And they care enough about you and what you contribute to the bigger piece of what we're doing that that's why. But hear that piece. I think that's the missing sauce, if you will, is that we have to tie what we do. I've worked with a lot of firefighters over the years in the public safety realm, because the class I teach, I teach a leadership class that deals with both, anybody in public safety. And I think there's a universal truth that the vast majority of people who are drawn to the public safety world come with a heart of service. There is something about this job and giving back and being willing to sacrifice, even making the ultimate sacrifice, and understanding that's a part of the job every day. That today could be that day that I'm willing to do, and I don't lose sleep over it at night. In fact, I'm proud of it, to take care of the people in this community and the people around me. And that heart of service is what drives us. And then we lose track of that. Like, we make it about the next pay raise, or who's got the better parking spot, or who's got the newest equipment, or the better office. And while those things certainly all have their place, I mean, obviously, if you're doing good things, it's nice to be rewarded. But we forget to tie back to why we're doing what we're doing. So let's take that into accountability. If I'm talking about accountability, there's two ways I can do it. I can have what I call a toe-to-toe conversation with you, where you and I, in fact, you and I can say, here's what's going on, and maybe even use the knife hand as I'm talking to you, kind of, I'm preaching at you. It's very confrontational. The other part of it is shoulder to shoulder. And I can stand beside you and talk about the path in front of you and the things, like, what are the things you want to do with your career? What are the things that are important to you? Is there going to be a point down the road that you're going to be interested in, taking the test for the next level? Is there a part that you're going to want to be in this specialty unit? So let's talk about how what you're doing today is actually keeping you from the very things you're going to want down the road. And more importantly, when you're doing the right things, look at who it's serving. Look at how that feeds our purpose and that part of what we do, and celebrate those moments when they happen. In other words, if realistically, we're more inclined to do the right things when we're recognized five times more for the things we do right than the things we do wrong. Tell me an organization that does that today. I mean, it just doesn't happen. In fact, you'll even hear leaders say, what, I'm supposed to thank them for doing their job? Why not? I mean, what is wrong with telling people that what you did was great? So, think about the work we do, Danny. Like we get this incredible opportunity to go in places where people are at their worst crisis, and that's our job. Like we go there in those moments to serve and take care of the community. And why wouldn't we be excited about, again, not in the moment, and not every trailer park you walk into, not every accident scene you walk up to is something you're going to be excited about being there. But big picture, the things that we get to do, the impact that we can make for the people around us, we forget to celebrate that because it's just Tuesday. It's just, it's just what we do every day. And you'll hear leaders say, "What, I'm supposed to thank them for doing their job? We've been on that call 100 times." Yeah, but for that family, this was maybe that most pivotal moment in their entire life together. This was a moment that for them is going to be memorable on a scale that for us it was just Tuesday. For them, how we interacted with them. Now put that into accountability. How much difference does it make about I come in and I just, give you bam, the bare ass minimum, and go home and do my job, or recognize in this moment that what I'm doing for me is Tuesday, but for this family is probably the most important thing I'm going to do for them all week, maybe all their entire lives. Which again, what I want to do is light the fire in you. I can't motivate you. Best I can do is I can figure out a line that I'm going to defend, whatever BAM line I'm going to defend, and I can coerce you past the BAM line or tell you to leave. But I'm not going to get your heart in it where when I'm not watching, you're going to do it. So when we talk about accountability, I want to see accountability dealt with where you hold yourself to the standard that we probably hired you for, that you probably brought in the door with you. And then unfortunately, we beat the hell out of you since you got here in a way that now you don't feel that same love for what we do or why we do it. But go to the end of a career, even the most grizzled old bastards have been around for decades. You still hear those moments where they recognize in their heart that what they did today was meaningful to a family, to a group, and they knew it. So I know that it's still there. It's just we just don't tie what we do to that. If we did that, I think the majority of accountability issues would be dealt with. The ones that are left, there are some people who are going to, I mean, I don't mean any disrespect when I say this, but there are some people who are going to choose behaviors that require us to thank them for their service and invite them to leave because they will not choose to do the role that we've asked them to take on here to serve our communities. And if you don't want to do it, thank you for playing. Have a nice day. Good luck. But those are few and far between. I think we focus more on those and less on trying to figure out how do I keep the fire lit in you, that you came in the door with about public service.
Right.
So long-winded answer in response to
No,
that,
I
but
love it. I love it. I love it. Okay. Why do some feel like when they decide to promote to a leadership role, that means that they can now do less?
Isn't that the truth? The people who do a great job at that level look like they're doing less. And what I mean by that is, so you promote one of the things is you're taking care of your people, spending time with them, investing in them. Leadership is about not just influencing them, but also developing them for the future so that they're ready to step into that next role, whether even if it's yours when it's time or even past you when it's time. So that's what we should be doing. But you write down your to-do list of the things you now have to deal with. And how many times have you stepped into a leadership role where you thought you knew what that role included? And then the day after you got in there, you realized that I call it the iceberg rule. You saw the 10% of the job that was above the waterline, but the 90% that's the bulk of that job that really takes your time, that really is difficult, where the organization depends on you to get it right. You never saw that because that you weren't exposed to it. Now you're there, and now you've got to focus. And so when you make your to-do list, man, 90% of it is stuff that you've got to get done because it's critically important, but it doesn't show up in my coming into your office and spending time with you or sitting down and just having a conversation and remembering to keep the relationship as an important, not as a task. Oh, I got to spend time with Danny. But I mean that hey, you know what? I haven't spent time with Danny in a while. I'm just going to go hang out with Danny for a bit because it feels like forever since we've talked. And again, there's a difference between those. Is it a task on my to-do list? Or in my heart, do I, hey, I feel like I haven't had this connection the way it should be and investing in my people. And that might be, about talking about your future. It might be talking about what your family's doing. It might be talking about, whatever it is, but it's about continuing to maintain those relationships. And so that doesn't make my to-do list go away. So the really good leaders recognize that investing in my people as a leader is one of the most important things I've got to get done, and I need to make time. And when I'm making time, I have to be fully present. I can't be there but on my phone. I can't be, sitting in the back of the room with my arms crossed and yeah, he was there but never engaged in anything. I've got to be present here. And I've got triplets who are adults now, and one of my daughters said to me something that it was profoundly changing for me. I said something about I didn't have time to do something. I just don't have time to do that. And she said, "I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just asking you to reword that statement because we say the words, I don't have time to, and we mean it. But we don't really evaluate what that means." She said, "So rewrite that script in your mind. Every time you're about to say, I don't have time to spend with my people. I got too many things on my to-do list. Say it this way instead. It's not important enough to me to spend time with my people. If you say it's not important enough to me to, and fill in the blank here, if that still rings true with the list of things you've got to do, then your stuff's in the right priority. But if you say that and you go, oh, I don't have time to go to my son's football game. Oh, that's easy. I don't have time to. It's not important enough to me to go to my son's football game. It's different. It forces you to relook at your priorities. And so I think good leaders recognize that investing in our people, that quality time, and it doesn't just mean BSing, around the water cooler or sitting at, the table eating together, having a meal together. It actually means investing in them both on the social side as human beings and on the professional side in terms of the things that they're doing. What's going on with you? How are you doing? That includes the person and the professional, and investing in them as a human being. Because again, that's where influence comes from. And again, I want to be really careful about saying that because if I'm doing it to try and gain a bank account that I can leverage against you, that's manipulation. That's not relationship. So it's got to come from an authentic place. You have to actually show up and really be there for the right reasons, or else checking the box of behaviors is not going to work.
Right. Now it makes so much sense. It really does.
Right?
So with that,
Yes, sir.
how can a leader help motivate or foster an organization that people want to be a part of?
I think it, so. Every interaction matters. I think you can't, and I think here's another place where I think leaders sometimes give themselves permission to cut the corner off of something, where they don't have. If I come in and I do things right 99 times out of 100, every once in a while I feel like, wow, I do it right all the time. I just feel like today, you know what? This says I can do it the way I want to. And that, but what I think we don't understand, when I see it happen, when somebody else does it, I know how that feels. Let me make a tell a story, make it a different way. If you come home and your significant other meets you at the door and gives you a hug, loves you, how was your day? So excited that you're home. And every day you're greeted this way. But one day when you come home after years of being greeted with a hug and a how was your day, you get punched with no reason. Tell me tomorrow you're not thinking about being. How many months have to go by before when you come in the door, you're still thinking like, I was hugged for 10 years, but one day I got punched. And this is with the person that I love more than anybody in the world. So now take that awareness that one time, maybe twice with somebody that I love, before I'm that's now going to be a part of everything, every interaction with them. That's always going to be in the back of my mind is today, that day. Now take that to the work setting with people that I don't love, and I don't mean that in a bad way, that I don't love as much as I love my spouse, my significant other, and that person. So if I am the leader that's dealing with my people, I there has to be every interaction I have with you matters. And if I get it wrong, which I will, I'm a human being, there are going to
Right.
be days that I'm going to just have a bad day. I'm going to say some snarky shit because that's what came to mind in the moment. I'm going to get angry and lead into my rank, and I'm going to yell, lose my shit over something. And all of those things are possibilities. And if they do happen, then I'm going to have to come back and own it with you and just say, hey, you know what? I ended up letting my emotion drive that interaction the other day. I realized I kind of lost it, and I'm sorry. I was not at my best yesterday. And hopefully, if I've got the relationship with you, but again, I want to create a space where you get to come and do what you came here to do. We're short on people that are coming into the public safety fields, but the people who are coming here, I still think the vast majority of them have a heart of service who understand what the job is and they do want it. I know there's a fear from a lot of people who've been around a while that all the people coming in, all they want is just a job and the benefits. Well, maybe there are some. Maybe there's more than there were, because again, we were competing for spots where now if we can't exclude you, we'll give you an opportunity. But that doesn't mean that that has to be the standard that we accept. I think every human being that does the work in uniform in the public safety world would agree with the statement, I'd rather work short than to have the wrong people in a uniform next to me.
Oh, yes, that's a fact. Yes.
So, I mean, that's just one of those things that I'd rather have the right people doing it. And if some people come in and we tell them why it's important and how do we do it, I want to create an excitement about coming to work and getting to do the job that you do. We all have had it at some point in our career, and then we lose it. And often we lose it, if you think about it, it's how rarely is it we lose it because of the stuff that happened out there. It's not the call I went on out there that suddenly made me lose, but it's dealing with this, it's dealing with them, it's dealing with this BS that never seems to undo itself. Yet we work in this stressful profession. And yet the inner secret that the people outside our profession don't get is that I would rather put my life in jeopardy and go out, for the cops to search a building in the middle of the night with an armed gunman who says he won't go back to prison. For you, it's putting your safety in jeopardy to protect or save a family because you see lives are at risk and what we could do here could save other lives. I'm willing to sacrifice mine to put myself there. We happily do that, and that doesn't cause us stress. It might cause us a little afterward, but not the same as all of the administrative BS, the leader who abuses their power and authority, the policies that just come down from above with no explanation about why the hell we're doing this, and it made my job 10 times more difficult. Anybody with half a sense would know that what you just did is stupid. And all of those are what create the stress for us. Why do they create stress? Because it keeps me from doing the job I came here to do. Otherwise, I wouldn't give a shit. I just collect my paycheck and go, yeah, that's fine. So you want to talk about accountability, you want to talk about motivating people. We've got to create an environment where I give you the safe places to play. Here's how to do this job. Here's where I'm going to have your back. If you're playing outside this boundary, you and I are going to have a conversation every day. And at some point, if you continue to choose out of bound behavior, I'm going to separate that behavior from this organization. So if you keep choosing it, you're effectively telling me you don't want to work here. Here's a safe place to play. Here's where if you do it this way, not only am I have your back, I'm going to celebrate the great stuff you do every day. This is going to be fun to come to work as much as, and again, I realize when I say that the public safety sector knows what I'm talking about. A lot of the public doesn't understand that. We love what we do. I don't want people to be hurt or injured, but when those things happen, because they inevitably will, I love that I get to be the person that goes there and try to make it better. I want that role. I embrace that role. And so I want to be a part of that. And so for me, it's all we're doing is creating a space for people to do what they came here to do and what they I think overwhelmingly inherently love and want to do and want to see how their energy can affect people around them and celebrate that. And just think, if we just did that, just that little piece of things, how much different would work feel like every day?
No, that's a, and that's that not everywhere, but I feel
No.
like talking to friends around the country, a lot of their issues stem from that. It's the mundane, ridiculous policies with no expert. Like, I'm okay if you're gonna drop a policy, but put the reason why behind it.
It's funny. I joke and say that, most policies shouldn't have a number on them. They should have somebody's picture. Because we probably did the policy because somebody did some
Right.
stupid crap that now we've got a policy about this. This should be the Dave Mather policy about why we don't do this way anymore. But those are easier because if that happened, at least people understand, okay, it's stupid. I shouldn't have to have a policy change, for this, but okay, I get why it happened. But when it's those things that just make the job more difficult, helping people understand. So I use the analogy of intent and impact. I usually go to the range, and for police, if I go to the range to qualify and I'm standing at the 25-yard line, when I pull the trigger at the 25-yard line, my intent is to put a hole in the target 25 yards away in the center of the target. But every time I pull the trigger, that's my intent. Impact is what the target looks like when I go downrange and take a look at it. And how often do you go downrange and there's one hole right in the center of the 10 ring from all 50 rounds that I put downrange? It doesn't happen that way. Why? Because all the little ways in which I went about doing what I'm doing, the environment around us, how skilled I am at making those, taking that shot, all affect the outcome. Now, as a leader, same thing. I may have golden intent every single time, aimed at the 10 ring of intent every time I make a decision. And every time I make decisions, like pulling the trigger, made a decision, I made a decision, I'm aimed at the 10 ring. As a leader, if I then go blow the smoke off the end of the barrel, reholster, climb in my car, and drive away telling everybody I'm an awesome leader because every time I made a decision, I was aimed at the center of the target. I'm forgetting to take into the account the most incredible part, which is what you and I are talking about, the impact of that decision on other people. I have to go down range. And when I start, I'm probably going to do some things with great intent that aren't even on the scoring portion of the target. And I'm going to need to get some help about how to focus my leadership behaviors in a way that the intent matches the impact. And if I don't do that, then I effectively have lost touch with reality while I'm patting myself on the back about, I pride myself in being a great communicator. I pride myself in being an awesome leader. How do your people feel about you? Oh, they don't even talk to me anymore. We're doing it so well, they don't even come and talk to me anymore. I'm like, there might be something there, right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. With that was actually going to be my next question for you. Communication. Now, I can say back in the day for me, when it came to our chief officers, our administration, it's like you want to tiptoe around. I don't want to be seen because if you're seen, then that means you're on their radar and vice versa. But now I understand wholeheartedly that just because they have, as you were saying, just because they have brass on the collar, the rank, the responsibility, it doesn't mean that they aren't human too.
Exactly right.
Because, like, for instance, I look at my fire chief, he puts his pants on one leg at a time,
Exactly
same
right.
as me. His
Exactly right.
rank is different, but we are still human beings. But with that, communication and for firefighters, we look at, well, we want to know what's going on. And I understand those that value the organization do, but, and there's the but, you have to
Yeah.
understand that they can only tell you so much because of privacy laws, HR, things
Sometimes.
like that.
Yeah.
But as far as affecting the organization and making them better, communication has to be paramount.
I agree. And I think it again, this all comes back to relationship, right? Because if it's something I can't talk about and I go, Danny, all I can say is there's some things about this that I'm not going to be able to share with you that would be critical that if you knew, if I could share them with you, you would understand why I'm making this decision. Now, if you trust me already, that that statement's all it takes. You're going to go, okay, well, I still don't like this, but I'm going to lean into that bank account of trust. Or I actually think it's more like a credit score than a bank account, if we're really being fair, because I develop it slowly over time, but one bad transaction can affect my credit score permanently. So, but if I've got a good leader credit score with you, following up on that, you're willing to trust me on this. I'm asking you to trust me, and you're going to just have to say, yeah, all right, I'll extend it to you on this one. But that's built over time. I don't get to do, I can't keep coming back every single time. Oh, just trust me, just trust me, just trust me. Because you're okay, after a couple, you're going to go, look, you're not actually answering any of these. And the worst part of this is that the way the human brain works, and I love this on one level, and it's sad on the other. Our brains are pre-wired to do two things: fill in the gaps in stories. We don't leave gaps. If you hear a loud sound, your mind doesn't go, oh, loud sound. Your mind goes, loud sound. Was that a car crash? Was that something being dropped? Was that an explosion? Was that a dumpster lid? Was that, I mean, your brain will go through and go, oh, I think that sounded like a dumpster lid. Even if you don't know what it was, your brain will go, okay, high five, I figured out what it is. And it's done. It's decided what it was. Now, that doesn't match reality necessarily. So pair that it rewards itself for completing a story, whether it's true or not, with the fact that our brains also are pre-wired to defend ourselves. It comes back from survival about what's going to hurt me, what's going to, what are the things that are trying to take advantage of me? How am I in danger? And my brain is pre-wired to see those to protect myself. So when those two things work together, how many times do you hear, understandably, that we have a new policy coming down that people go, oh, I wonder what this one will be? It's immediately to that, oh God, another policy. Like, I already know this is going to be negative. I am preconditioned to expect, based on history, that this is not going to go well. And so now, coming back into this idea of communication, the more I can communicate with you about the why, the better. But here's the other part, and I'm going to take the administrator side for just a minute. I will work with agencies that have, I've got a chief that puts out a weekly email that takes him several hours to write about all the key things he's doing at his level. And again, not a huge one, but like a little blurb on about 20 things that he's done this week. And he takes the time every week out of his schedule to put that together. And this is a man who, when he's up at 5 o'clock in the morning until he goes to bed 11 o'clock at night, 6 days a week, that man is involved with being the chief. Now, when he's engaged with you, he's joking and laughing and having a good time and communicating and having, I mean, he's present, he's enjoying that moment, but he puts in a lot of hours outside of that to develop all these things. He puts out those emails. His door is always open. He has said, what can I do to, I'm always asking for, what do you think? In the meetings, he'll say, what do you guys need that's not happening? And people will kind of give him the old arms crossed, watch him and say nothing. And the minute after he leaves and the meeting's over with, they have the conversation in the hallway that he was asking them to have. Well, communication is a two-way street. I realize some administrators shut that down. But I think a lot of, and again, go back to that idea of, 99 times done the right way, and one time when I ask you for feedback and I beat you for it, I'm going to create an atmosphere that shuts it down. So, I mean, I realize I have a huge responsibility as a leader to be, if I ask you for feedback and you give me something that I don't want to hear, I still have to be receptive to it. I don't have to accept it as right. But I have to thank you for doing the thing that I asked. I asked for feedback. Nobody else in this room spoke up. Danny, thank you for, thanks for at least sharing what you're thinking. I'm sure others are thinking the same thing. Let me address what you said. Now it's communicating. Now I'm thanking you for doing the very thing I asked for. So I've got to create an environment that welcomes communication. Let me switch sides again without circumventing the chain of command, because what I don't want to create is a place where you're not going to talk to anybody until you see the chief in the hallway, and then you want to engage in conversation with the chief, missing everybody in the chain of command, because that's also not going to be a helpful way to get things done. So we've got to figure out this balance, and no surprise here, if you're kind of paying attention to the theme here, it comes back to relationship. if I'm working for you, it's about you and I building the kind of relationship that when you say trust me, I go, I do. I would love to hear more if you're ever able to tell me more. In fact, I probably, because we're friends, would, again, you're still my boss, but would you consider telling me what, like if I wasn't, like let's say I was your boss, what would you say? I mean, I might try to con you into giving me more, but at least there's a relationship there I can lean into and trust. And so communication comes back to how much you trust. Because think about it, if you don't trust the person giving the communication, you won't trust what they've communicated to you. So yeah, but I think we also have to work really hard to create an atmosphere where people feel free to ask the questions, that we still, support our chain of command. I don't want to circumvent my leaders in between the top and the front lines, just by opening that door so, that they think that the open door policy means that I don't have to talk to anybody else. No, it means that if you need to circumvent because they're a part of the problem that we're dealing with, that you have that option. But it doesn't go from here all the way to here. It goes to this leader
That's
or to
right.
that leader. And again, use it. Anyway, yeah. So it's a
No,
complex piece, but
you hit it on, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with it because, yes, open door policy, but that doesn't mean that you should be able to bypass, like you said, those individuals instead of going straight to the source. Where, and then to me, when you have that, that's where the issues happen within your organization where individuals feel like, well, I don't have to go this route because this person does.
Yeah. So, artfully, I would say that as a leader, obviously, if somebody takes the time to come into my office and they've circumvented the chain of command, I'm not going to just shut them down or throw them out because, again, I want them to know I do care about what you're doing, but there's a right way to do it. So I've got to find this balance of validating that they felt trusted me enough to come and have the conversation with also reinforcing my trust in the leadership system. And so sometimes, if I do have trust in the leadership system or helping to rebuild it, if I don't. But that also might mean something as simple as saying, Danny, I appreciate this issue that you're dealing with. Have you had a conversation, with the sergeant, with the lieutenant yet, with the battalion chief yet? Here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to go and engage in the same conversation you just had with the lieutenant and have a sit down with them and ask them. Don't go in and, complain, but go in and ask, just like you did with me, like, what should I do? That kind of open communication. And then I'd like to hear back from you in a week or so and just hear how that's going. Just like how did it play out? I want to know, but I want to put you back down where I think you need to start with this. It there's a lot of layers before it should come to me. Not that I won't be here if it needs to come to my level. And the other thing I'm going to do probably is I'm going to, as soon as you and I get done talking, I'm going to connect with the lieutenant and say, hey, just a heads up. I had one of your people come and talk with me, and I asked them to come back and start a conversation with you. I also asked them to close the loop with me afterwards. So I just want to let you know that they're coming back. And so if somebody comes in and like starts a conversation, if you happen to be distracted in the moment, realize that they're probably doing it because I asked them to. So make sure you're fully present, engaged, and do your best. And then let me know what you need from me to support you. So now I'm working both sides of the system to reinforce that chain of command in between. Because I'm not shutting my guys or gals down who come in to talk to me because I want them to always know it's safe to do it. But if this one isn't one that should circumvent everybody and go right to the chief, then I'm going to try and refocus it where it needs to be and then follow up on it to make sure. Because I want you to know if you brought it to me, this still does need to be addressed. So.
You brought up one thing and I know I've seen it happen quite often, and I don't know if it's because it's just the year or the time that we're in now, but when somebody comes and they want to have a conversation with you, if they're talking to you and you're scrolling through your phone or you're reading an email or you're answering a text, like to me that just shuts it down. It doesn't even want to make me talk to you because you're not really engaged. But the thing is too, I think some of these, whether it's a sergeant, lieutenant, captain, whatever, they're so lost and maybe they don't realize that that's what they're doing.
Yes, I totally agree. I'm embarrassed to say it, that as a sergeant, I had a lot of things to do, and I prided myself in getting my stuff done before I went home the other night. So I could literally sit here and type while looking at you, and continue to have a conversation while I'm typing. Like I literally could do both, but to your point, I'm also sending a message that was not what was intended, but the impact of what I'm doing says you're not even important enough for me to stop doing what I'm doing right now and engage fully with you on this. So again, there's an artful piece of this too, is as a leader, if you come in and you need my time and I'm in the middle of doing something, if it wasn't something you and I set up ahead of time, go, grab a seat. Yeah, Danny, grab a seat. Give me 5 minutes. I want to finish this thought that I'm working on. Because if I don't, the whole time we're talking, this is going to be like, my brain's going to be re-editing this email. So give me like 5 minutes just to finish editing this and get it out. And then I can give you my uninvited attention. And, or I've got this and this and this. The next time I've got available would be this, where I could really give it, give you my undivided attention. Would that work? Or do I need to reschedule things? Is it important enough that I should reschedule? And at least I'm empowering you to tell me how important this is to you right now. And then I have to make a decision whether I'm willing and able to reprogram some of my schedule if need be. But I think, and again, once you recognize how important the relationship is, then there's no way that I'm going to, keep typing away while I'm talking with you, because I already know what it feels like on the receiving end of that. I would never want someone to feel that way while they're engaged with me. So how do I, yeah. So it's fair to say, hey, give me just a second to finish editing this email and get it out, or at least finish my thoughts, or I'm going to lose it. And then the whole time my mind's going to be trying to rewrite that, and I won't be able to give you my full undivided attention. And then focus and do what you got to do. And then when I turn to you, then I got to remind myself, turn that part off for a minute. Why am I here? What, and again, I think purpose-driven. Why are you here? We talk about communicating and we're asking people to communicate the why. I think we also have to remind ourselves of why is this time block that I'm about to work in important? Because I'm engaging with somebody who needs my help. They've come into my office asking for my time. Maybe they're emotional. And I'll say that's another side trip there too, that sometimes the message is wrapped in inappropriate emotion. I just heard Simon Sinek say the other day that they gauge the level of response with the problem that's being talked about. Somebody comes in a few minutes late to work and you just say, hey, notice you came in a few minutes late, and they explode. Well, the reaction doesn't match coming in a few minutes late to work. So probably this is not about coming in a few minutes late to work. There's something else in the world going on, and being empathetic as a leader enough to know that's not about me. There's something going on in their world here, and how do I support them and figure out what we can do to help them, as opposed to reacting to the emotion. And now any type of communication you and I are about to have is lost. Because now I'm reacting to you being pissed off and you're mad about this, and so-and-so is an asshole, and I can't believe we do this stupid, and why the hell are we? And I'm reacting to all of the, you're being insubordinate and you got to knock that off. Okay, guess what? I've lost every chance now I have of finding out what's at the core. Now, the wrapper is still inappropriate. At some point, when there's enough trust between us and it's the right moment, I want to talk about how can you and I have a conversation before you're at that level where you're so pissed off that you come in wanting to peel the paint off my walls. Can we figure out a way to have you come in like when you're mildly peeved instead of all the way pissed off? Like that would be such an improvement in what we could communicate about. So again, but when I get somebody who is that angry, if the emotion doesn't match the moment, there's something more going on here. And so I've got to be listening, not just for the message, but what are some other things that might be happening that are creating that reaction, they're going to be the very obstacles to communication today and in the future if it's not handled well.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, I love it. We kind of hit on it, but I want to hear your take on it. So, leaders being open to constructive criticism. Now, I'm assuming both police and firefighters, we can be smart asses, we can be
Oh, yeah.
jackasses at times, but if a leader comes to all right, you could kind of say both police and fire this would relate to, but if a leader decides to rotate and visit the shifts and ask the crews, hey, what are some of the things you need? What are some things that we can improve on? if you have an individual that respectfully, of course, and you have to do it with respect and tact, and there's got to be a time and a place. But if they go, hey, chief, sergeant, whatever the case may be, we're having issues with this. We're feeling a certain way about this. As a leader, you shouldn't get angry at that individual and shut down. Like you need to be open to hear, correct?
Right. Yeah. No, I think so. I guess I'll go back to what do you want? Like, why are you having the conversation in the first place? If I'm asking you know, or you're taking the time to come, what do I want? I want people who are going to tell me when things aren't working the way that they should be. Either it's a real problem, a miscommunication, or a misperception of what we're actually doing, which is also tied a little bit to that miscommunication. So the problem is a problem. Because it's creating their, you know, how do employees take that? What do they do with that anger, that frustration, if it's unresolved? Well, they tend to do what I call malicious compliance. They find ways to do the letter of what you've asked me to do while intentionally warping the spirit of it, so that you can't say, why I you need to go out and do, need to go out and do more business checks. I don't want to do more. I didn't ask if you wanted to. You need to go out and do it. So you go out, and in every business, you start citing them for every damn little thing that's out there. And they go, "Why are you guys suddenly such assholes? Hey, chief said to do more business checks. You got a problem. Here's his card." And so I get a call from the store, and I go, "Man, your people were assholes. They came out and they wrote me all these cites and, for all these things going on." And I call you and I say, "Hey, what's up with this? Hey, you said more business. Now you don't want me to do it? You hear it? Like, you're going to do on purpose a undermine my intent with the way you approach it." So again, unresolved frustration, to me, frustration, if I see somebody who is visibly emotionally frustrated, one of the things that my mind does is say, the only time we get angry about stuff is when there's a gap between how it should be and how it is, which means I still care about how it should be. If you care enough about how it should be to be angry that it isn't there, this is an opportunity for me as a leader to hear whatever it is that's creating that anger. Now, if I can help you, if we can help resolve it, sometimes I can't. Sometimes I'll just say, yeah, that's one I would love to change. Unfortunately, that's outside of the agency completely. That's a dictation from outside sources about how it will be done. And until we get enough that we can get that changed, we're kind of stuck. Okay, I don't like it either, but there's a different feeling when you know. Oh man, I thought the chief could change this, and I just found out the chief doesn't like this either. I feel differently about the chief when I know that he thinks this is silly too, but he can't change it either. Then if I think you've lost all sense of what it means to do what we're doing. So I think to me, the concern is, and I think a lot of leaders struggle with this. I certainly did as a young leader. If my own insecurities become more important than the role that I'm doing, which it's easy for it to do without me realizing that that's happening because I'm worried about people. You and I went up for the same promotion. I got promoted, you didn't. And now I feel like you're just out there every day trying to figure out how to prove to everybody you should have gotten it, I'm the one. And so now that's driving everything that I'm doing. I'm creating a series of behaviors that are about trying to prove that I deserve to be in this spot. I'm already in this spot. I have to quit letting my insecurities drive my behaviors as a leader, which sometimes does happen for some people. If you're mad about something, if you're frustrated, I don't care how it comes about, especially if I asked you for what do you think, and you go, "Well, this is stupid. Give me more. How is it affecting what you're doing?" And I'm not going to react to the emotion right now. I'm going to try and get to the core of what's behind it, because and say, "Well, all right, what are your thoughts on this, or how does are you aware of this? This is a factor that we're having to consider right now. Knowing this, how would you approach it differently? Maybe if you got a better approach than the way we're taking." And I think there also has to be enough humility to realize that if the direction you're going, if my intent and impact don't match, and somebody tells me a better way to achieve the intent where the impact will actually match it, I've got to be able to go, "Man, you know what? I wish I'd thought of that. So let me do some work on that and get back to you. But I at least at first glance, that feels like that would be more effective than the way we're doing it." Now, again, if I do that every single time, there's going to be a problem. If I have a, you're not going to trust me because of a lack of competence. But to assume that as a lead, I mean, as a human being, when I'm the one in that spot, I don't expect that people are going to, I don't expect myself to get it right every time. I know I'm going to make mistakes. I'm a human being. But when I look up, how many times do I expect them to get it right 100% of the time? And when they get it wrong, when they make a bad decision, I'm just ready to vilify them. I'm ready to beat them up. And I promise you that all of what you feel as a human being, regardless of where you are in your organization, whether you're at the front line, at service delivery doing it, whether you're at first level supervisor, mid-management, all of the things that you feel about doing your job at that level, you will also feel at the senior command level. If you're wearing in the chief's office, when you're in the corner of the puzzle palace, in Mahogany Row, you're going to have the same kind of thoughts that you're having today about all these different things as a leader. The difference is it's lonelier. There aren't other people in the organization who do what you do. And so you're talking to other agencies, or for a lot of them, they just kind of shut down and stop engaging with people. And because on some level, what you're saying, I'm concerned about. So, I mean, I think to me, emotion and emotional communication means you still care. I'm more worried about it if you don't care enough to even care. Apathy is a bigger deal to me than pissed off. Pissed off is a gap between what is and should be. So.
Okay. All right. This is a it was one of the questions I thought really I wanted to like articulate it in a way that I'm sure other people will definitely wonder themselves.
Cool.
Does the culture of an organization fall solely on the leader?
Yes and no. So I think the desired culture should be is the senior leaders, the chief executive officer's responsibility for setting the desired culture. Now, that said, that conversation should be had prior to them being selected. In other words, I'm going to be hired or elected or, depending on what role I'm playing, by a community of people who want something from their public safety entity. They have a desired culture. Now, maybe it's they want something different than what they've got. Sometimes they just want a few changes in it. Sometimes they love what they've got and they want to see it sustained. So I think that the community itself is going to dictate. The agency, our agencies are nothing more than a microcosm of the society around us. So, I mean, we to pretend like we're living in a bubble because we all sleep in the same house. we're fooling ourselves into believing it's the same as if, different station houses are somehow different under the same organization. Things might be a little bit different, but we're all still kind of the same. And we see it, especially when I look at the neighboring fire jurisdiction or police department and go, I see how they are different than we are in ways that actually I can truly see those differences. We're all doing the same job. So the vision of the culture and about where I should go if I'm the chief executive, I need to communicate that. I need to tie it to everything we do. It should be a part of how I recruit, how I hire, how I train, how I promote, how I do specialty assignments, how I discipline, how we anything. Again, and I want to make it simple enough that everybody can get their heads wrapped around it. It's why I like values in particular. We all know what we exist to do. And I can't remember the all of it, and so hopefully you will. I remember it's an old one, and it was oversimplified, and a lot of people, made fun of it later. But Phoenix, when they kind of switched Phoenix Fire, when they, their mission was what? Be safe, have fun, and I can't remember, there was another part of it too. But basically, everybody understood it. Now let's tie this because it was about service too, and so now let's tie what you're doing back to what our mission is. So it. Mission, vision, values aren't supposed to be accreditation. Hey, look at this plaque I got up on the wall that says, that somebody went through and asked the right people the right questions, or we penciled it in a way that made it look like we do. I mean, let's be honest, right? That's what they are most of the time. The question is, do you in your heart believe this is what represents us? That's the version of culture that I want to create. And culture is to an organization what personality is to an individual. If you're going to know what to expect from me the more time you spend around me, because my past behavior is good. That's why, like there are certain people in the house that if there's a new policy that we're going to hear about, you want to be there early enough to watch so and so's reaction to it. Why? Because every time there's a new policy, they overreact and it's a fun show. That's personality, that pattern of behavior. Culture is a pattern of behavior at an organizational level. So what is it that's important to us? It's interesting. I'm working with an organization right now where I'm a leadership and wellness consultant, and one of the things that I'm focusing on, I got asked a question by one of the senior leaders in a very friendly, engaging, positive way. I was dealing with some administrative issues that were going on, and he said, "I don't," he said, "I'm not, you're not intruding. I just am curious. How do you tie this to wellness?" And I said, "Because I think having a culture of leadership that we know that our leaders care about us, that they're protecting us, that they're giving us a safe place to do the job, that they're celebrating the things that we do right, they're holding people accountable in a coaching and guiding way, creates the kind of environment, the kind of culture, if you will, where people want to come to work. They're not going to leave for more money someplace else because is only an issue until I've got enough of it. If you offer me more money, I'll take more money. But I will leave for a place that pays less if the culture is healthier there and the people who work there go, we love here and I would never leave here. I will go to a place less and figure out how to make my budget work for less. So money is not the issue. I want to know that what I do is appreciated, respected, that I'm valued as a human being, as an employee. We say all the time that our employees are the most important part of our organization. And then we treat them like they're not. So culture has to align. We culture isn't what I put up on the wall. Culture isn't mission, vision, values, unless it's tied to those coping underlying behaviors that we figure out, like, what can I get away with? What am I going to be held accountable to? Why do I do this work? What is important around here? Who will be rewarded? Why will they be appreciated? What are the things that, I won't tolerate now either as a member of this organization when I see other people doing things that are damaging to our culture. Hey, we don't do it that way here. You might have done that in the place you came from, but we don't do that here. Like that's culture. When my peers, like my senior officer pulls me aside and said, "Hey, what you're doing, that's a healthy culture." I just didn't understand that at the time. It was just an old dude telling me how to do my job. But boy, talk about shaping the future by holding each other. If you and I, as brothers on the job, are holding each other accountable to the right ways to do things, think about what that means for the whole organization. That's a healthy culture.
In your opinion, if it's not coming from the leader, can the boots on the ground assist with getting the culture there, or?
Sure. Yeah, I think yes. I mean, we're always going to, this. I think the best way to talk about, in the police world, I say, when we talk about, I say, will we ever solve crime? And of course, everybody goes, no. And I say, will we ever stop trying? No. Exactly. Culture itself is a breathing, living entity. It's not a. In fact, if you treat culture like a destination, you're going to have a problem. I'll pair culture with losing weight. You decide you want to lose 15 pounds and you set the hey, I'm going to change things. So I'm going to, have a egg white spinach, no flavor bullshit omelet for breakfast. I'm going to go on a run. And then at lunchtime, I have a little portion and I do all the right things all day. And at the end of the day, I get on the scale and nothing's changed. It's like, well, why'd I do all that? We're talking about persistent over time. In fact, let's take another step. If I do that for a month and I drop those 15 pounds in a month, what do most people do when they hit their target weight?
Stop.
They stop doing all the things that got them there. So if I treat our culture as a destination, hey, I want to lose 15 pounds. As soon as we hit that 15 pounds and we all high five each other because we got there, we're going to stop doing all the shit that got us to that point in the first place. This has to be the lifestyle change about who we are here, how we do it here, and not how I do it. How do you do it? How do we all do it? How do we hold each other accountable for that version? So, yes, it can come from the front line about this is who we are and what's important. And you'll see that sometimes. If there's a healthy culture, that does good things, and you get an outsider that comes in as a chief executive who doesn't honor the healthy parts of the culture that exist, the rank and file at the front lines will bond together to protect what's important to them. At the same time, if you're not modeling it from the top, your message about what the culture should be is going to be completely ineffective. I don't get the latitude of going, well, I'm the chief. It's got to be 100% of the time. So, yeah, it's not an option not to. So,
Mic drop. Awesome.
yeah.
I tell you, awesome. Awesome. Yes. Awesome message. I love it.
Hey Danny, I gotta say thank you, brother. I know, you know, being the first one not coming from the fire service and you know, Esco kind of suggesting we might have a conversation. I'm truly grateful for the opportunity to chat with you. I really do. I mean, I think there's so much that we give each other a bad time about, and you know, and that's part of the brotherhood and sisterhood of being in public safety, I think. But we're all cut from the same cloth. We've got hearts of service who want to do good things in our community. We have different roles, different responsibilities, and certainly different ways about going about that at times that don't always mesh up. But in our hearts, I think we're cut from the same cloth. So I
Absolutely.
appreciate the opportunity to have been with you.
No, I appreciate Ricky for because he sent me the message and he's like, hey, he's like, I know you do fire guys, but I'm telling you, he was like, I'm in a class right now, you need to get this guy on. And I was like, okay. And he was like, I already did all the legwork for you. I already talked to him about you. He's like, here's his number, contact him. And I was like, all right, I will do. And I'm not gonna front, like, I was like, how can we make this work? But by talking to you, listening to how it's the same, the police and fire, even though we are in two different entities, we're still in the same field, but it's the same issues.
Yes. I think when you get down to it, Danny, leadership itself is fairly consistent. You know, I think there's very few exceptions. Where it becomes different is in the heat of the moment, leaders in the fire service and police service in the military in hospitals in, you know, where in schools, wherever it is, have to know enough about, they have to have enough competence in the knowledge and the role that they're playing at the moment to be able to take charge and do what they've got to do in a very dynamic environment where lives are in jeopardy. But the vast majority of time that we spend in our organizations has to do with interpersonal behaviors about how human beings interact with each other. And that's universal. People, you know, begged me to kind of let firemen in the class. And it wasn't that I didn't want firemen in my class when I started, it was that I didn't know any fire stories. And I finally let a few in because they're like, they actually said we're arson investigators, so we have criminal enforcement, you know, on the arson side. It's like, okay, I guess. And they said, look, you're telling cop stories because you know cop stories, but all of what you're doing, I can immediately relate to exactly how it happens in our house. So everything you're talking about here, we're not talking about the tasks that I have to do in law enforcement or the tasks that you have to do in firefighting. We're talking about this idea of how as human beings in a semi, you know, kind of this quasi-military environment lead each other as human beings in an effective way so that people feel valued when they come to work, they feel respected for the work that they do, and they will get to walk away at the end of a career knowing that they did something that mattered and can celebrate a life of service. Which unfortunately, so few of our people that leave actually get to do.
Right. How? No, actually, before I get to that last question, I want to ask you one more question
Yeah, go
because
for it.
I want to hear your viewpoints. How can an organization create officer slash leadership development for the future leaders?
Yeah, I think it starts with recognizing that how we're doing it is not how we want it to be done. And I think also having enough humility as leaders to be willing to change up what we're doing. And not making it, we keep looking for this magic bullet mic drop. If I go to this one training, it's going to change everything. Bullshit. Because again, it's not the training. I've got certificates from training that I never did one damn thing from that training. So I got credit for not getting kicked out of class for 40 hours or 150 hours or whatever the hell it was, but doesn't mean I did a damn bit out of anything in that class. So this has less to do with, less to do with the magic bullet. We're talking about creating an environment that the people who are here feel valued, feel respected, want to give their best efforts. They know safely where they can do their job. They know that the leadership trusts them to do it. The leadership can defend them when they're doing it, and has the moral fortitude as well as leaders to push back on the community when the community is making unreasonable expectations or demands upon the agency. But I have to be able to defend internally before I can defend externally. If I'm already uncomfortable about being it, it's a, I mean, being a chief executive is difficult. I don't know all the people in the organization if it's a big enough agency, but any one of them could do something tonight that I will lose my job as the chief. So I could do something as a chief and you won't lose your job over it necessarily, but any one of the members can do something and I would. And I'm not feeling sorry for the chiefs. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that when you talk about, when am I willing to put my reputation on the line? When I know that we as an organization do things the right way for the right reasons, and that's what we're trying to create. So I think and the toughest part of it'd be cool if everybody stepped into a new organization with nobody and we're all getting to know each other and we all agree this is what we want to build. The truth is, and I think the toughest part of changing culture becomes, I've got a history in this organization, and when I was a supervisor, I was not a very good supervisor. And you remember that because you worked for me and I was an ass and I didn't treat you well. I mean, yeah, okay, I showed up and helped you move, but at work, I didn't really care about what you wanted, only what I had to do and my reputation and my career. And now I've promoted into a senior leadership role, and I'm asking you, come on, Danny, give me the. And the toughest thing, I think, is for us to give room for people to grow, develop, and not hold them accountable for their worst day while also holding them accountable for doing the right thing. Because I am going to make mistakes and I have to be a good enough human being. It's not even a leadership behavior, a good enough human being to apologize when I screw up and be willing to learn to do it differently. But I also need, on some level, if I'm going to be judged by my, think about it, if we were all judged on our worst day, how do we get anything accomplished? We're all going to have days and decisions we wish we could go back and take back. Some of them are huge, some of them are smaller. And so how do we create an environment going forward that allow us to create the environment we want together? It's relationship. I mean, it comes back to, how do we create that? I can't dictate it from above. I can't go out and send people to a training. Great, everybody went through this 120-hour class, and so now they're all going to start doing this. No, I got to get you in your heart to want to do it differently because you understand why it's important to you. And that's such a personal level that I can't do it from the chief executive's office. I can do it with my deputy chief and assistant chiefs, maybe. And they might be doing it with their battalion chiefs, who might be doing it with the captains, who might be doing it with the lieutenants. But if it doesn't, soon as that chain starts to break down, the message disappears. So if I'm the chief and I'm doing it with my direct reports at that level, I'm also going to be checking with their people to make sure this message is making it through intact to the next level. And they need to be making, and I'm not like, Danny, your guys don't know what the hell they're doing. It's like, hey, I had a conversation with your guys and I'm not sure they're getting it. What's the conversation been like when you talked with Dave? Because I feel like he's not. Talk me through what this looks like and feels like. So again, it's about us creating this place in a way that we are proud. I want it to be the kind of place that when your kids are old enough to think about doing this job, if you don't try and talk them out of the work that you do, you shouldn't be, there's a lot in the law enforcement realm right now. Like, I wouldn't want my kids doing law enforcement. But if what I say to them is, if they said to you, yeah, but I'm going to do it, would you want them to work here? Because if you don't want your own kids or somebody you love to work in your same organization, that's the culture piece. Forget recruiting. That's your recruiting issue right there. My own people don't want the people they love to come and experience what they're experiencing here. That will be an obstacle to everything else we want to accomplish. that's a place to start. You, I don't care what kind of YouTube videos you do on dancing and water bucket challenges and whatever other bullshit that goes with it. We're not bringing people in to an environment that I'm not going to bring people I carry into an environment that's toxic and I'm going to eat them up while they're here.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Man, that's fantastic. Dave, how can individuals reach out to you to get you to come to their organizations and explain what your consulting firm does?
Yeah, and so my firm is me. I'm a one-man show. I don't have a website. I'm on LinkedIn, Dr. Dave Mather, and that's it. I mean, I have been, I've been so fortunate. If you told the guy who was sitting in my office in Cheney as a commander, who got this offer to go and take over a group for DOJ, if you told that guy what he'd be doing today, almost 20 years later, he'd have had a drug, he'd have had you drug tested. Because like there's no way that I could have foreseen this journey in front of me. And what's been so amazing about it to me is that it has been 100% about word of mouth. Just like you got connected because of Ricky Esco. Those kind of conversations are what has, and I've just kind of been going from here to there. I'm on an embedded contract at the moment with an organization that invited me in to come in and basically give me free rein to, hey, we're looking to improve our wellness and leadership cultures. What do we have to do? And I mean, phenomenal opportunities. LinkedIn is the best way to get in touch with me. My email address would be secondary, and that's but I always respond to it, and that's Dave at whatsamather.com, WHATSAMATHER.com. That's it. You won't find
Okay.
me. You won't find a website out there. Because I'm just all, it's all been word of mouth, which I take a lot of pride in too, because it means that the things that we're doing matter enough to you to share it with somebody else.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one more thing too before we part.
Yes, sir.
Organizations need to realize that there's not a perfect organization out there. I mean, we're
Nope.
all human, we all have our faults, but if the individual, if the leadership truly wants a change, they have to be able to maybe swallow that pride and take that pill that, hey, we do need some outside counsel. It never hurts to get a fresh perspective.
Yeah, culture is interesting. If you've worked in the same organization your entire career,
Yes.
you know what the fire service is to you based on things that there are things you do there that are industry standards. And the fire service is a lot better than police in this side of things for sure, because you have national standards that everybody talks and teaches to. But there are also some things that you do, the ways in which you do it, the ways in which you engage, the ways in which you interact with each other that are uniquely your agency, but for you, they're fire service. And if you suddenly went to another agency and were embedded with another agency, they would suddenly become very apparent because now you're seeing what's different than how you're used to seeing it. So one of the advantage, I mean, there's an advantage and a disadvantage as an outside consultant. One of my favorite things I tell people all the time, I've got the easy job as a consultant. I don't have a position of authority. I'm not somebody saying you need to do this or you need to do that. Everything I do is based on influence. So I'm going to have a conversation with you as a leader in the organization and talk about why I think it should be different. I'm going to explain to you the why, but you are going to have to decide whether you're going to do something different or not, because whether I'm right or wrong, you still have to take ownership of it. So it's a great place as a consultant because I'm not going for your job. I'm not looking to have your job. I'm not competing for promotion. I'm sharing this because I think the organization and you will benefit from a change. And here's what I'm advocating for. Some of them you'll take and some of them you won't. And that's okay. As I jokingly tell people, I only had one feeling and the ex-wife got it in the divorce. You're not going to hurt me if you don't do what I say. Like I have no authority. I'm making recommendations and I'm going to tell you why. You have to weigh the value of that. So I think the benefit of an outside source, especially on something that does what I do, is that my only loyalty is, and I tell even the all the way up through the chief executive, my loyalty is to the organization. And that will usually mean to all of you as well, but there will be times where I think what's right for the organization and what you're doing are differently, and I promise to have that conversation with you, but I don't have the authority to change anything. So my having the conversation with you doesn't make it wrong. I'm sharing an outsider's perspective. You may know more than I do that I'm privy to, and that's why you're making the decisions you're making, but I'm gonna share it with you. So I think you know there's a real I'm always impressed by chief executives who are open to the possibility of somebody coming in, especially with the latitude that I'm often given, because again I've got a free license in here where I'm at to basically be involved in any part of it. That's a tremendous amount of trust and not something I take lightly. So.
Love it. Babe, I appreciate you coming on, spending time out of your day to do this. I
Thank you.
love the conversation. I didn't think it would go so well. I knew it would go well, but man, like it really went well. And I truly appreciate the message that you're preaching. And I hope that the listeners can take a little bit away to make themselves better for their own
Awesome.
organization.
If there's anything I can do to support you, Danny, or your followers, you know, please have them reach out. I'm not looking to make a buck off of it. If there's something I can do to help out, you know, especially those easy questions or just gosh, I'm not sure what to do on this. What do you think? Have them reach out by email or on LinkedIn and connect with me, and we'll schedule a phone conversation. Like I said, it's so
Fantastic.
appreciate you, my friend. Thank you for
Yes.
doing what you do.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right. Be safe.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.